from NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. While jobs, businesses, daily routines have all ground to a halt, rent and mortgage due dates have not. For the millions of renter households who have lost wages, the first of the month is now its very own crisis. Many states have protected renters from eviction during the shutdown, but others have not, leaving a patchwork of protections across cities and states around the country. And as more of the country inches towards reopening, what happens to renters when those extra protections disappear? And what's the impact on landlords, especially small property owners who may rely on the rent for their own income and businesses? So this hour on Point, rent, eviction, and COVID-19. And we're going to begin today in Kansas City, Missouri. Tiana Caldwell is a renter and a leader with KC Tenants, a grassroots affordable housing organization, and she joins us now. Tiana, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Meghna. My name is Tiana Caldwell, and I am a leader with KC Tenants here in Kansas City, Missouri.
Let me just ask you, Tiana, on June 1st, when it rolls around in a couple of weeks, will you be able to pay your rent?
No, I won't. And like millions of others across the country, I'm terrified about it because our rent and mortgage moratorium for our city lifts on the 31st. So we've been organizing around trying to be heard and behind that with our local officials and statewide, even starting a statewide coalition where we represented 34,169 Missouri tenants across the state. And we have not been addressed, not even seemingly acknowledged by our governor. Thank goodness for the mayor who did put a moratorium in place. But like I said, it will end on the 31st. Yeah. And then what will people do then?
Well, do you mind if I ask you, are you facing possible eviction?
I am. I have recently, just last week, received paperwork for an eviction.
So you received an eviction notice?
I did. I am due in court on June 11th. They see the deadline for the moratorium coming close, and it's like vultures, you know, coming to pick at the carnage. And I am a two-time cancer survivor. Even if they do take off the order to stay at home, it's not a climate that is safe for me.
To go back to work, you mean?
Right. To even be out there. My particular position, the company, they are going to be delayed if they're able to open at all because of this pandemic. And that's the word that we've received. We don't know when or if it will open back up.
Were you laid off, furloughed? What happened to your job?
Initially, I was laid off. As this progressed, I don't know what's happening with the owners and the people who run the company. But I have received word from my boss. I received word from my boss maybe 2 weeks after we were off or everybody had to stay at home order. And I received word from my direct boss that they didn't know if they were going to be able to open back up at all. Uh-huh. And if so, it would be severely delayed. I have congestive heart failure due to the after effects of cancer, my diminished lung capacity, and a diminished immune system. This is not the climate that I should be in, mm-hmm. you know, whether it is to find employment or to go back to work. And I'm terrified. Mm. My family is terrified. We're doing everything that we're supposed to do. You get notices that don't care about whether you eat, whether your children are eating, whether you can afford your medication that you need to live. They just want their money. And this is not our fault. No one's. This happened to us.
Yeah.
This is not something that we created. And just the fact that there was a moratorium for any amount of time lets us know that they know it's not our fault.
Right.
So how do you just throw us to the wolves after that?
Right.
If I wasn't working for months or weeks, and I couldn't pay the rent during that time, just because you open it up on this day doesn't mean I'm going to be able to pay it that next day. How?
Right. Tiana, do you mind if I ask, have you had, is your landlord an individual, a company? I mean, have there been any conversations about coming up with kind of even a temporary solution to help you get by through this time?
They said to stay in touch with them, which we had the whole time. It's a property management company, mm-hmm. and it's near impossible to get in touch with the direct owners. And it's, you know, conversations that are, you know, have someone that's going between, there's no connections there. It's hard to tell whether it's the property management that wants to continue to make their profit or what's being told to the actual owner. I would think that no matter who it was in this climate that they could see, I mean, it's a pandemic.
Yeah.
It's not, I mean, if you can look across not just the country, but the world, and the most disheartening thing for me is to see other countries come to the aid of their citizens in a way that our country has not. Mm-hmm.
Did you get a check from the federal government? Did that help at all?
We have not gotten it yet, but we did. We are part of that and are approved and should receive that. But with the delay in unemployment and everything else, I feel bad even for my family because I feel like my medicine is consuming all the resources that we have. And it's vital. And these are the problems that millions are facing across the country. You shouldn't have to decide between in a pandemic and an emergency and something you did not create. You shouldn't have to decide between your vital medication and food or rent or whatever your child may need.
Yeah, no one should have to decide between food, the medicine that you need to stay alive, and having a roof over your head. What are you going to do, Tiana? Do you know?
It's to the point where my husband, it's not safe for me and he can't take it, but he feels the need to do something. It's to the point where he's probably going to separate from the family so that he can go back to work without putting us in any danger or exposure because it's so vital for my health. And so he will be separated from the family and out of the home. And we don't know when he'll be able to come back, when it'll be safe for us. And I can't imagine braving the rest of this crisis without him. Mm-hmm. Family should not have to be broken up because of this.
I am so sorry, Tiana, that this has happened to you. And it doesn't help at all to know that it's happening to millions of people. I mean, as you said, this is a pandemic. It's hitting everyone so hard. You're one of the leaders with KC Tenants, right? A grassroots tenant advocacy group. Are you hearing similar stories from other tenants in Kansas City?
We actually created a hotline, and it would blow your mind. You know, just here in our area. And, you know, we know that our officials and our government know that it's a problem because we have our mayor fielding calls to us, Healthy Homes, the statewide program that they put in place to make sure that homes are healthy and people have what they need and they can live in their health. All these people are sending those calls to us because there's nowhere to field them. And people are in pain and they're suffering. And it's not their fault. And it's not being answered. It's not being acknowledged. There are signs everywhere that it is seen and that it's known. So how do you not do anything? How do you not help the people? How do you not give the people what they need?
Yeah. Well, you talked about how, I want to be sure I have this right, that the rent moratorium is that is being lifted on the 31st of May. Is that all across Missouri?
Yes. This is local. They didn't call it statewide. Okay. Our governor would not. Yeah, he would not. This was citywide here. Thank goodness for our mayor. He went ahead and called it. It was going to end this week, but he did push it back to the 31st.
I see. And
I'm not sure if that'll be reevaluated, but there's been protests and stuff, and people want things back open. They have opened up the city. I mean, not completely, but they're starting to. They've lifted the stay-at-home ban, which terrifies me. The numbers are still strong. Mm-hmm. I watch them every day, and I have to watch them every day because it is literally life or death for me. Mm.
We've got about a minute left, Tiana. What do you need to have happen for you to keep a roof over your head and your family together?
We need a rent cancellation. We need for it to be longer than just however long they call this. We need that restoration period. We need to be able to recuperate and to rebuild, right? And it's for all of us, because the way that this will affect the economy and everything else is about all of us. I would love to see our country, the greatest country in the history of the world, the riches, come to aid and do what only it can do. I see all these other countries doing things, but this is America. We can do more, and we should.
Well, Tiana Caldwell is a grassroots leader with Casey Tenants. They're organizing to help fight for tenants in Kansas City. And as you heard, Tiana's facing eviction come the end of this month. Tiana, thank you so much for sharing your story with us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, when we come back, we'll talk a lot more about the eviction crisis that's coming, potentially, for many Americans. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking this hour about rent and COVID-19 and the eviction crisis that many Americans may be facing as mass unemployment and rent come head to head. Seattle City Council President Lorena Gonzalez sent us this message about a bill she helped pass in Seattle that would protect tenants from evictions even after the city's original eviction moratorium ends on June 4th.
This pandemic has created the need for many of our tenants, many of our low-wage and hourly wage workers to really find the time to work their way back to economic stability. And the legislation that I sponsored and that we saw unanimous support from my colleagues on provides tenants who are recovering from this crisis an additional 6 months of housing stability through an added defense in eviction proceedings after the city's eviction moratorium ends.
That's Seattle City Council President Lorena Gonzalez. Well, joining us now is Matthew Desmond. He's principal investigator at the Eviction Lab at Princeton University, the first nationwide eviction database. He's also a professor of sociology at Princeton and author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning book, Evicted: Poverty and Profit in the American City. Matthew Desmond, welcome to On Point.
Thank you, Megna.
So first of all, I wonder if you might give us a snapshot as to what eviction protections that are currently in place in the United States look like. It feels like it's quite a patchwork.
It's a big patchwork. I think that many Americans think that evictions aren't happening today, but they are. In many states across the country, eviction courts are still going on. In fact, some states have figured out ways to hold remote eviction hearings by Zoom or by telephone. There are certain states like Massachusetts, Delaware, Connecticut that have instituted pretty strong protections for renters during this crisis, but many other states have not. And as Ms. Caldwell was speaking to at the beginning of the hour, many of the protections that are in place are set to expire at the end of the month.
At the end of this month, right? And so that's just a couple of weeks away. I mean, we heard in Tiana's story that means they can, these families see the crisis coming. I mean, they're in the crisis right now, and it's going to reach kind of the point of no return in just a couple of weeks. What are they to do?
If nothing happens, we are headed for a full-blown homelessness crisis, which will translate into a worsening and deepening of the public health crisis we're already in. If housing is our best medicine during the COVID outbreak, it is unconscionable that someone like Tiana has to worry and fret during this moment of collective trauma about her health and her family's health because she can't make the rent. I think that this is a time for serious government action, and it's a time to really extend the message that housing is just so essential to every part of our lives, health being one of them.
Mm. Can you tell me a little bit more about the states that you think are doing it right now? I mean, is it that they have just put a temporary moratorium on all evictions, or are there additional supports for renters that are either in the works or in effect?
It's both.
Okay.
So eviction has a beginning, middle, and an end. You initiate the process, you hold court, and then you execute the eviction at the end. So the states that have the best moratoriums have stopped the process at the very beginning. You can't initiate an eviction. In many states, the initiation is still happening, which is just backlogging the courts. And when those moratoriums lift, it's just going to flood courts and means the spike in evictions are going to happen. So the best states have said, look, we're just going to put a stop to the process right now. I also want to stress that if families get an eviction filed on them now, and even if they don't lose their homes, that still is really bad for their lives.
Mm-hmm.
An eviction record can affect their credit, can affect their housing search options, can affect their public aid. And so stopping the eviction before it starts is really crucial. And then other states have rolled out other protections for tenants, including beefing up rental assistance, making sure their lights and their gas stay on during this crisis as well.
I mean, I think you've also even recommended that that eviction should not be or the beginning of eviction proceedings shouldn't be reported at all, at least at this period of time, to credit agencies.
That's right. I mean, this is something that can really follow a family around. In some states, if you have an eviction on your name, it can really affect your wages getting garnished. It can affect your ability to buy property years later. This is a mark that can cause you significant disadvantage in the future.
Right. So, Matthew, I raised something as seemingly basic as the impact on credit, even though it's a profound impact, because what you wrote about in your 2016 Pulitzer Prize-winning book, Evicted, is about the long-term impact, right? The health, the emotional, the well-being, the financial impact that eviction has, that families end up in a kind of cycle that is out of their control and not even their fault. So, I mean, can you tell us more about what those long-term impacts are?
Sure. So before the crisis hit, we saw about 300,000 evictions filed every month around America. And eviction causes loss. Families lose their homes. Kids lose their school. You often lose your neighborhood, your community. Families a lot of times lose their things, which are taken by movers or piled on the sidewalk to be scavenged. It takes a good amount of time and money to build a home, and eviction can just delete all that. As we talked about, eviction comes with this mark, which can cause you to relocate to a worse neighborhood and to worse housing, because a lot of property owners are seeing that mark of eviction on your name and saying, no thanks. So it pushes families deeper into disadvantage. There are studies that show that eviction causes job loss because, as you heard from Tiana, it's such a stressful and crushing event. It can cause you to make mistakes at work, lose your footing in the labor market. And then there's the effect that eviction has on your soul, your mental health. Now, studies show that mothers who get evicted, for example, experience higher rates of depression 2 years later. And I think when we add all that up, eviction is not just a condition of poverty, it's a cause of poverty. It's making things worse. And in today's climate, it will be a cause of disease spread and death.
Mm. You did much of your early research in Milwaukee, right?
Right.
So can you, I mean, for the families that you followed there, did you see exactly those outcomes over a long period of time, that they were thrust into a cycle of poverty, that perhaps they, you know, they weren't impoverished to begin with? Did you see that?
So many families who face eviction are pretty hard up when they face that.
Right. Many
families are much worse off after they get evicted. And so I saw families move into mobile home parks with no heat. I saw families separate and be broken up, like Tiana spoke about. I saw families descend into sickness and real dread and depression. And so absolutely. And then against these experiences are statistical studies, right? Our big data that we can put behind it to say, you know, this isn't just a few families that I saw in Milwaukee. This is something that's affecting millions of Americans every year.
I see. We talked about the state-level protections, temporary protections that are in place. But I should note that I think the CARES Act has some eviction protections in it for renters that are supposed to stay in effect until late July, right? If I think it's for properties that have government-backed loans on them. Is that right?
That's right. We got to remember, though, that most tenants, most renting families in America do not live in public housing or government subsidized housing. Only about 1 in 4 families who qualify for any kind of housing assistance receive it. So for those 1 in 4 families, the CARES Act extends to them. But for the unlucky majority, most of whom in normal times are paying half of their income to housing costs, they're left out of most provisions of the CARES Act. This month, there was a new bill introduced in the Senate called the Emergency Rental Assistance Act, which would extend $100 billion in rent relief to renters. And that tries to fill in the gap that many people think the CARES Act left.
I see. So 25% coverage there through the CARES Act. And Matthew, I want to talk more through the remainder of this show about solutions and what should be done, because we're talking about millions upon millions of families here. But I also want to spend a little bit of time talking about landlords, because, yes, there are lots of big corporate landlords out there, but there are also a lot of small property owners. They're not nameless or faceless. They may be as reliant upon the rent that comes from their investment. They might be reliant upon it as their sole source of income. And we actually heard from quite a few small property owners who are feeling the financial stress of this moment as much as anyone else. For example, here's Sue. She owns a duplex in Eugene, Oregon. She rents one half of the duplex to tenants, lives in the other half, and also has two other tenants who rent rooms from her. And Sue told us that the incoming rent from those tenants pays the mortgage or covers the mortgage, but that's pretty much it.
I was lucky and I have an FHA loan, and I felt like it would only be fair to extend the terms of my relief to my tenants, 3 of 4 which lost their jobs. I lost my job as well because I worked for the college here, and as soon as everything happened, the college is shut down. And I haven't gotten unemployment yet because I can't get through. So at this point, I'm completely living off what little savings I did have.
And Sue said, you heard her say that she's lost her job, so she has not been able to save a lot of money. And without that federally backed loan, Sue told us that she understands how other landlords could be backed into a corner.
I just recently qualified for SNAP benefits, nutrition benefits for the first time in my life, and I'm taking advantage of that. So I have food, I have a roof over my head because they're not going to cancel my electric while this is going on. But it doesn't change the fact that I don't have a dime to my name and I have no one paying.
That's On Point listener Sue from Eugene, Oregon. And Matthew, I wanted to bring that up because, I mean, small property owners may not be able to enjoy the scale or the margins that corporate property owners do. And these rent moratoria are really quite challenging for them. They don't necessarily want to evict their tenants, but what options do they have?
So we have an eviction moratoria right now, but we don't have rent moratoria.
Good point.
And I want to kind of disentangle rent from eviction. You know, I think you're right. You know, a lot of property owners out there are feeling the pinch like many, many Americans are. And so what's the solution there? The solution isn't to evict the families like Tiana's. That's not going to solve their problems, especially in their climate. Eviction is a bad solution most times, and it's a horrible solution during a time where most of us are sheltering at home for public safety. So I think that for Sue, you know, petitioning her government leaders for help is the better way. Asking the federal government and state governments to come to the relief of both renting families and small property owners, I think, is the solution forward. I also have to say, you know, in an average year in America, 3.7 million evictions are filed every year, 3.7 million. And did we ask, you know, during those years, what about the tenants? You know, what about the tenants? And I'd like us to just take a moment to reflect on that and think about where our sympathies extend and why, and reflect on how cavalier I think we've been about people's homes and how easily we've treated eviction as a solution when it's just another problem.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point. Matthew, I want to first of all say thank you for clarifying, because I didn't intentionally conflate rent and eviction there, but in the course of live radio, sometimes I do have slips. So thank you for catching that. No, I really appreciate it. Yes, evictions are one thing, and we'll talk about them more. But since I did make that slip about rent cancellation, I think the reason why I made that slip is because there are some efforts that we've been reading about for groups are calling for rent cancellation. I mean, is that a viable solution?
When I've spoken to tenant leaders on the ground, folks that are calling for rents to be canceled, what they mean is not we want landlords to go out of business. What they mean is there's pain, deep pain, which we heard at the beginning of the hour, now. And we need a solution fast and now. And we need that solution to cover everybody, not 25% of us, not 50% of us, everybody. And canceling the rent is a clear way to do that. Now, federal bills that have kind of responded to this kind of push from grassroots organizations like Tiana's, like Representative Omar's bill in Minnesota, also have provisions to cancel mortgage debt and mortgage relief as well, to have landlords in mind. And so I think those calls from tenants are not calls that are about hurting someone like Sue. What those calls are is a call to do something immediate, swift, and now.
Mm. Well, we did hear from, as I said, from several small property owners. This is Alex from New Orleans, and he told us why he's opposed to canceling rent.
I am a small landlord that receives part of his income from the rental properties that I own. I don't have mortgages on all of them, but I still have bills personally that are due, student loans, and my own mortgage. So it seems unfair to cancel everyone's rent. It seems like if the government wants to help everyone, they should help workers and citizens by, you know, providing some type of basic income so that they can provide for themselves and families while we're going through this.
That's Alex in New Orleans. A couple of quick points there. First of all, Matthew, you had talked about the call for not only rent cancellation, but mortgage relief or cancellation. Have those proposals made any meaningful progress?
I think what you're seeing at the federal level right now is many more co-sponsors getting behind a big bill to get rent relief out there quickly. I do think, though, at many local levels, the calls for both cancellation of the rent, cancellation of mortgage are growing. You know, we haven't seen a moment of tenant activism like this since the Great Depression. Mm. You know, that was our last great moment of a swelling of rental power. And I think we are seeing hearkening back to those days. And those days brought us things like public housing in America. And so on a symbolic level, on a level of stretching our imagination, I do think the canceling the rent campaign is catching on. On a federal policy level, it looks like the rent relief bill is moving at a quicker pace.
Mm. Well, we are talking this hour about the crisis that renters are facing because of the COVID-19 pandemic, and really the crisis that that means for millions of American families. And how long might that last? How deeply might it affect them for months, years even? Matthew Desmond joins us. He's the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of Evicted, Poverty and Profit in the American City. We'll have a lot more when we come back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Tomorrow on the show, we're going to be talking about childhood. It's supposed to be a time of imagination and magic, but what is childhood like in the middle of a historic pandemic? So we want to hear from you and especially from your kids. Get them on the phone and tell us, what is childhood like for them right now? And by the way, if you live through a past major sweeping historic event or time, how did that change you as a kid? What was it like experiencing that as a child? And how did it stay with you as an adult? Call us at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. We're going to be talking about childhood on our show tomorrow. Today, we are talking about the crisis that American renters are facing because of the COVID-19 pandemic. And not just renters, but also we heard from many small property owners about how they are trying to survive this time. Alan Jones owns 31 rental units in Columbus, Ohio. In March, he called us and he told us that in March, he emailed all of his tenants with information on rental assistance programs, along with this message.
The most important key is to keep a roof over their head. It's more important than utilities, car payments, tattoos, etc. And come April, everybody paid. Now, two of my tenants did get help from Homeless Families Foundation. May, everybody paid. And again, the two got help from Homeless Families Foundation. But right now, everything is fine. And we're just going month to month. But keeping in touch with my tenants, I think, was the key.
That's Alan from Columbus, Ohio. Marjorie called us. She owns a unit with one tenant in Somerville, Massachusetts. When her tenant could only make half of the rent last month, here's what Marjorie said.
I told him that was okay. I can get by. And I feel that it's my responsibility to help him. I'm lucky enough to own this place. He's a good tenant. And when people say we're all in this together, I think we should take it seriously.
That's Marjorie, an On Point listener in Somerville, Massachusetts. I'm joined today by Matthew Desmond. He's a principal investigator at the Eviction Lab at Princeton University. And joining us now from Boston, Massachusetts, is Lisa Owens. She's executive director of City Life Vita Urbana, a grassroots community organization. They're part of the Homes for All Massachusetts Coalition, which pushed the state of Massachusetts to instate a moratorium on evictions and foreclosures during the shutdown. Lisa, welcome to you.
Thanks so much, Meghna, for having me on. And I want to thank Tiana for sharing her story and Matt for his research and his advocacy.
Can you tell us a little bit more specifically about what Massachusetts has done. Matthew pointed to that state a little earlier as having put into place sort of model protections at this moment.
Yeah, definitely. But, you know, I want to start by saying that any conversation about eviction really needs to begin by mentioning the history of structural racism in housing policy and practice, because the impact of structural racism can be seen today in our high housing instability and our disproportionately high eviction rates, and now in our high COVID-19 contraction rates. And if it's okay, Meghna, I'd like to just really quickly paint you a picture of before, during, and after the crisis. I'll be quick.
Sure, go ahead.
So before the public health crisis, Black communities and other communities of color in Boston were already bearing the brunt of high eviction filing rates. So our organization has been working with some researchers at MIT, and among other things, we found that Black communities and communities of color were experiencing much higher rates of eviction filings in both subsidized and private market housing. And, you know, there are many stats about this, but it's one thing that really kind of paused all of us when we were doing this research was that 40% of all eviction filings in our city occurred in majority Black neighborhoods, even though only 18% of rental housing actually exists in these neighborhoods. And that's important to know because it gives you a sense of what was happening before the pandemic. Mm. And then during the crisis, these same communities that were being that were sort of living under the historical sort of weight of structural racism are now exactly the same communities that are being hardest hit by the pandemic right now. So before our moratorium passed, but during the state of emergency, 78% of eviction filings were happening in communities of color. These are the same folks who are going to be the first wave of people evicted when our moratorium ends. So it's really important to just set the stage that way.
Yeah. Can you just hold on for a second, Lisa, because these are very bracing numbers. And I just want to get Matthew to comment on this. I mean, do we see the same pattern of disproportionate impact on communities of color regarding evictions that Lisa was describing was going on or what even was going on before the pandemic in Boston?
Absolutely. Lisa's on point to draw our attention to the structural racism story behind this crisis. If you go to the Eviction Lab website and you look at how evictions pattern across concentrations of African-American residents, you see really high concentrations in majority Black communities. This disparity is not erased by income. It exists at all levels of income, as far as we can tell in our data.
Mm. So, Lisa, your point being is that that problem, which exists before, didn't magically go away because some eviction protections were put into place.
That's exactly right. And so the impact of the pandemic, the public health impact and the economic impact compounds what was already there, right? So we now have a temporary pause in evictions and foreclosures. So City Life and our Homes for All partners across the state, as you mentioned, we fought for and we won, according to Matt's research, the strongest eviction and foreclosure moratorium law in the nation. And among other things, it stops evictions and foreclosures from the very beginning of the process to the very end. And it covers tenants, working class homeowners like caller Sue or the caller Marjorie that called in, and small businesses, actually. And it stops late fees and the negative credit reporting that Matt was talking about. So this is an impressive first victory, and we're really proud of the temporary pause that we won. But we know, and you've been talking about, the fact that renters will still be faced with a mountain of unsustainable back rent owed because we still have the obligation to pay rent, as you mentioned. And once this pause is lifted, we're expecting a tidal wave of evictions that will hit our communities the hardest, right?
So this is the thing that's truly worrisome, as if we could become even more worried than we are now. But But because there's sort of this pent-up tidal wave, which is likely to hit regarding renters, I would say there's also a tidal wave of foreclosures, which may hit homeowners once they lose their protections.
Absolutely.
But in addition, because of the all-encompassing nature of this pandemic, really the solution is people getting back on their feet financially. But how are they going to do that? I mean, I think Tiana's story was a perfect example of that. She, even if the business that she worked for reopens because of her existing health issues, she's very concerned about going back to work. So we're looking at, I don't know, months, perhaps years, as the economy sort of struggles back, of people being in a terrible state of limbo. So I feel like, Lisa, we need some really creative solutions now that are going to last more than a quarter, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, you know, Matt, when I wrote this down, when you said that evictions aren't just a cause of poverty, but now evictions are a cause of disease spread and death. Right. So that's what's at stake if we don't have some bold, bold policies that go beyond a quarter, as you say. So but the good news is that good, smart housing stability policy happens to also be good public health policy. And we know we've been doing this a long time. We know what these policy solutions are. We need to be thinking big picture beyond the recovery. The people, we need to be thinking about a people's bailout on the order of magnitude of what was given to the big corporations. And we say we need three things. We need one, to stop the wave of evictions that we expect will happen after all of these temporary protections end. Two, we need to cancel the obligation to pay rent and mortgage for working class homeowners during a time when many, many people are unemployed and risking their lives to remain employed. And three, we need to forgive the unsustainable amount of debt accrual that's threatening to crush people, millions of people under its weight. Mm. And Massachusetts residents and specifically can get involved by going to housingguarantee.org, where you can join the movement to fight for all three of these things.
Yeah. Well, Matthew Desmond, what do you describe to us in detail what you think some smart long-term policies might be to help people get through the next couple of years?
Well, we need immediate solutions right now. And so we need rent relief at a scale that is at the scale of the problem we have on our hands. So not just a little here, a little here, but now. One of the big lessons from 2008 was we didn't act soon enough. And when we acted, we put all these provisions on our aid and really hobbled our ability to address the foreclosure crisis. You know, we have a fire going on. We shouldn't have to worry about conserving water. And so I think that I think we need to ask now, which means not asking renters, for example, to prove that their rent has been affected by the COVID outbreak, which one of us hasn't been affected by the COVID outbreak in America. We could also rethink these basic housing provisions in the United States and expand them. You know, if only one in four families who qualifies for any help gets it, can we think of those other three out of four families and expanding, for example, housing choice vouchers or Section 8 to those families to help them get through this time? I also think we can think of eviction as the very, very, very last resort and not as a court of first resort, which it too often is treated in America.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point. Lisa and Matthew, hang on here for just a second, because On Point producer Dori Scheimer has been keeping abreast of our online comments about this issue, and she's here to share a couple of them.
Yeah, we heard from George on Twitter, and I want to say a lot of the comments that we got were from landlords who are very concerned about the same things that we talk about renters being concerned with, that there's this pile of bills that keep coming, whether you're getting any income or not. So George on Twitter said, you know, landlords rely on their renters to pay their mortgage. If the renters don't pay rent, then there may not be the money to pay the mortgage on the home the renter's living in. I had five rentals in 2008. Three of my renters lost their job and were unable to pay rent, which made it hard for me to keep up on the mortgage, plus the taxes and miscellaneous to keep up to date.
Okay.
So again, this public health crisis possibly turning into a housing crisis similar to what he experienced in 08.
Yeah. So Matthew, we touched on this earlier, but it's sort of the tentacles of this crisis and how far they spread. And it got me thinking about what you just mentioned, that eviction should be the solution of last resort. So what would come before that in a way that would both support and help the renter, but also, say, the small property owner like George we heard from?
One thing is rent relief, making sure that the rent gets paid and the tenants get to shelter in place. Another thing is debt relief, making sure mortgage or rental debt or other kinds of debt, as your listener talked about, is forgiven or subsidized in a different kind of way. I just think squeezing families who, even before the crisis, were already pushed to the brink. You know, before COVID, most renters below the poverty line paid at least half their income to housing costs. Squeezing those families is not a solution. Evicting those families is not a solution. And I think that this kind of tension point is an opportunity to ask, well, how did we get to this place, mm-hmm. you know? Metered rents in America have doubled over the last 20 years. The profits for landlords, in a study I put out last year, are double in poor neighborhoods compared to landlords in non-poor neighborhoods. I think this is a real opportunity to ask, you know, what parts of the system were broken before? And how are those cracks just expanded during this public health crisis?
It's an opportunity to ask that. But we've also said, similar things in previous crises, and yet even if the question was asked, the solutions weren't followed. I mean, we talked about 2008. Do you think it would be different this time because of the scale?
That's up to us, I think. That's up to us. And I think it's up to us demanding from our leaders, from our nation, real relief and stability. I really resonated with what Tiana was saying earlier in the hour, where she asked, basically, you know, what is the benefits of membership in this country, this wealthy country, if it just doesn't feel like that to so many people?
Mm-hmm. Well, Lisa, we've got about a minute to go here. Do you see this as potentially a transformative moment? Because we're all so taken aback by how this pandemic is touching all of our lives.
Absolutely. So we're in a time where millions upon millions of people don't have employment. People are talking about the Great Depression. We're comparing our this time to the Great Depression. Meanwhile, this government has given trillions of dollars to big corporations and will give them trillions more if we let them. We can choose that. Or we can choose to do things radically different, right? We can choose a people's bailout.
Well, Lisa Owens is executive director of City Life Vita Urbana, a grassroots community organization in Boston, Massachusetts. Lisa, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Matthew Desmond, principal investigator at the Eviction Lab at Princeton University. He's also a professor of sociology there and the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of the 2016 book, Evicted, Property and Profit in the American City. Matthew Desmond, thank you so much.
Thank you.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.